Investment Division meeting will come to order. Tuesday, we had a very stimulating meeting about what the governor was offering as a result of his tours and Commissioner Franz's tours with MMB across the state. And I joined in, of course, with the results of our extensive 17-day tours of tours across the state. And we certainly all discovered that a bonding bill is important to all the people and communities of the state. And although it's not time to discuss the criteria that goes into how a target is established, or how three targets are established, we know that the governor's target has been established for his proposals for bonding in investment. This committee started last year with an attempt to talk about where we thought we should be going in House File 2529, which is still alive and well, sitting, being cared for by Representative Carlson and Ways and Means Committee. That number may have to be adjusted as a result of what we're going to hear in the next 2 weeks, today and the next week after that, and the following weeks. But while we're contemplating all this, we can't fix ourselves at a certain amount, because we're given new information every single day. And maybe today's day is the scariest of all. We're going to have three presentations that have requests for the future, and talking about why some of the requests are way more than we would have anticipated. It's because in the past, as I review the past bonding era, there was almost like a set figure, and a figure you couldn't go beyond to contemplate. And so we are going to hear several times today, I believe, about deferred maintenance, things that we have to catch up on because there wasn't enough money before, or the choices that were made were for those presentations, or the presentations that we are going to hear, that other agencies or other proposals had more priorities. But holy cow, today we're hearing from the largest, and right now we're going to hear from the very largest. And the number of buildings and the number of years that they've been serving the state and organized as a department. And you know, when we went on those tours, they said, oh, our buildings are now 30 years old. Well, this morning we're going to hear a building that's 100 years old. And yet they've had about the same amount of investment over the years of their lives. And that doesn't make some sense in some ways. But I'm not going to go on because we're late. And we have, they were told 30 minutes, but they don't have 30 minutes now. It's about 25 minutes apiece, and we don't want to overlap. And so please begin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Stroman. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And here with me is Assistant Commissioner Shannon Lotthammer. And we are very pleased to be here this morning to present the governor's recommendation for bonding for the Minnesota DNR. What we would like to do is just briefly, because we will adhere to your time here, is provide a little bit of context in terms of how we determine the capital asset bonding needs in the department, how the recommendation is shaped, a little bit of that context, and then we'll go into the overview of the request itself. So first, just to set the stage of how this request sets in the priorities of both the DNR and the governor, under that kind of key priority of public safety and asset preservation, this request really focuses on taking care of what we have, infrastructure that serves the public and community prosperity, and ensuring efficient DNR operations. And then the second larger bucket priority is quality of life, and under that our focus is on equitable access, community prosperity, and preserving Minnesota's natural and cultural heritage. These are all key parts of our mission at the DNR. One thing that I think is always important to frame the conversation around DNR's bonding recommendation is just to understand a little bit the portfolio of capital assets that we manage, because it really is very different from other agencies. Our assets are very diverse, and a diversity that most other agencies don't have to deal with. And so the fact that we do have this diversity of assets really requires a different approach for the request and for how we manage these assets. And here, these are just some examples. And what you'll see is, you know, a lot of times we tend to think about capital assets and buildings, and we certainly have many of those, and we have a variety. We have visitor centers, we have camper cabins that public can come and stay in, we have fish hatcheries, we have offices where our employees are housed, we have shower buildings in our campgrounds, but we also have things like dams and water control structures, roads, trails, bridges, fishing piers, public water access ramps. And then we have lands, like our state forests, our scientific and natural areas, our wildlife management areas. And so all of these things together really make the management of those capital assets complicated, because they're such different kinds of things. The other thing about our portfolio of capital assets is they are extensive, they are numerous, and they are geographically dispersed. So DNR has assets in all 87 counties in Minnesota. We manage 5.6 million acres of land. We manage nearly 3,000 buildings. That includes 225 work sites for our employees. And all of that includes about 30,000 building components. So if you took the individual roofs, windows, HVAC systems, that would total up to nearly 30,000 components across all of those buildings. In total, these capital assets are worth about $3 billion. In terms of their replacement value. So with this diverse and extensive and dispersed set of assets, how do we determine what our need is? And I think what we have found at the DNR is the need for a very systematic approach. And I think, interestingly enough, both the prior commissioner and I have city council experience, and so the frame that makes sense to both of us are the capital improvement plans, capital asset plans that cities do. And so the DNR has done much the same thing. We have a capital asset needs report that we do every 2 years, and this report really is a way for us to assess all of the assets that we have, assess their condition, and then determine based on those conditions what are the needs that we have over time to maintain those. And so our approach really is this 10-year approach, that the assets are too numerous and too dispersed to address in a single bonding bill. So we take this approach over time, and our request is really based on the data and the information that we have based on the inventory and assessments of our assets. The other thing that's a little bit different about our bonding approach, and again, because of the nature of our portfolio, is that our focus is programmatic rather than project-based. So we will talk about some of the projects. We do have projects, but the vast majority of our request is based on programmatic. And so these are our natural resource asset preservation program, our betterment of buildings program, acquisition and betterment of land program, and the dam safety program. And again, the reason for this is because our portfolio is so large. Again, with nearly 3,000 buildings and 30,000 building components, we couldn't come to you seeking approval for every roof, every HVAC system, every shower building individually that needed to be replaced. We would never get through that in 25 minutes. We'd be here for weeks. The other thing is it creates efficiencies if we can do this programmatically, because sometimes things pop up with that number of buildings that become more urgent than something else, and it allows us to create some flexibility across the system and make sure those dollars are getting where they are most urgently needed, again, in order to fulfill those priorities of serving the public, serving our employees, making sure our operations are efficient. And it also allows us the flexibility to address some of that invisible infrastructure, things that are sort of hard to sell to the public because you don't see them, but are ultimately extremely important. And a good example of that would be our wastewater systems, for example, at our state parks, critical to running our campgrounds, but not things that the public sees. Same with trail culverts, critical to providing trail infrastructure that people all across Minnesota enjoy, but not something that people are going to see and say, yeah, let's go out and fund trail culverts. So this programmatic approach ensures that we are able to address all of those needs across the system. And then we do have projects you'll see in our wildfire aviation infrastructure. We have a project around improving accessibility to state parks and a project around Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park. We have grant programs then, and these are bonding dollars that come to us that we pass through, and these are critically important for addressing some of the needs of local communities. So we'll get into the specifics of our request. This slide really just presents a high-level overview of our bonding package. And so you'll see those programmatic buckets, the largest of which is the Natural Resource Asset Preservation Program. That, as in past years, as you have heard from us in the past, is really our greatest and most important need. That is where we have the most deferred maintenance. The chair promised I would use that phrase, so I'm going to. You'll see the other DNR programs, and then you'll also see those few projects there. There is a lot of detail in our request. Obviously, it is a large request at $196 million. So we are not going to walk through program by program or project by project, but what we'll do is walk through several themes so you get a flavor of what these programs and projects are. So we'll start with the natural resources asset preservation. This is under the category of public safety and asset preservation. And we'll get to the building components, but I want to focus a little bit on some of the non-building components of this request first. This request, as I said, is the largest part of the DNR's request and the recommendation in the governor's bonding proposal at $70 million. This category generally includes buildings, water and wastewater systems, roads, trails, bridges, water control structures, campsites, that includes our group campsites, our day use areas, monitoring wells, and hatcheries. So as I said, this is our number one priority. It includes a wide array of these built assets that really support our operations, our services, and the programs that we provide to the public. You'll see up here a picture of the headwaters at Lake Itasca. This is just one example of the need in this category. The water and wastewater system at Itasca has extensive needs, and it's going to take a number of requests and years to address it, but we are starting to address it. We're using some 2018 bonding dollars, and we need additional bonding dollars to complete the project here. When you think about our campgrounds in our state parks, they are like small cities. Every season they are open, they attract many visitors who spend nights there, and so they are really like small cities in terms of the infrastructure, the wastewater and water infrastructure that we need to provide. And it's really vital to ensuring that the public can continue to use those resources. I will note that from time to time, as that infrastructure ages, we find ourselves out of compliance with the PCA requirements on those. And that is the case at a number of our state parks, and Itasca is one of those. And that's why it's so urgent, particularly at the headwaters of the Mississippi River, to make sure that we have a wastewater system that is functioning in a way that protects our clean water. So I think this is kind of a classic example of the urgency of some of the needs here and what this category includes. We'll move on to some of the building components. As I said, we operate nearly 3,000 buildings, about 2,800 buildings, with 30,000 individual building components. One in four of our buildings are in unacceptable or poor condition. That's back to that deferred maintenance. Nearly one in three of our buildings are over 80 years old. Only one in four of our buildings meets today's design and building standards. And folks might ask, well, why do you have so many buildings then? You have a lot of old buildings that need a lot of work. The reality is that buildings support every single part of DNR's mission. If you think about it, not only do they house our employees, but they house visitors at our state parks. They provide visitor centers that welcome people. They are camper cabins that people stay in. They store our equipment that serves the public, our enforcement vehicles, which includes not only cars and trucks, but off-road vehicles, our snowmobiles and our ATVs that are needed to maintain our parks and needed to enforce our game and fish laws. So it's all of these things, our hatchery buildings that raise the fish, that stock our lakes, that support a multi-billion dollar fishing industry in this state. So I can't emphasize enough how connected these buildings really are to our mission. And so assuring that we can upgrade the conditions of them and ensure that they continue to serve the public is really important to what we do and to our quality of life in Minnesota. And these are just some examples of photos. You'll see the Spire Valley Hatchery Office, the floor in our Zimmerman Forestry Building, the roof on the Itasca Park Visitor Center, and an I-beam post at the Lanesboro Fish Hatchery. Some of these are now under construction thanks to previous bonding bills. But this just gives you an idea of some of the conditions that our employees face when they go to work, or unfortunately some of our visitors to our facilities face when they enter them. The other thing on the buildings that I want to note is that you'll see we have two categories. We have buildings in our Natural Resources Asset Preservation Program, and we also have buildings in our Betterment of Buildings Program, which is being recommended at $25 million. And there's a distinction between these two categories, so I'll just take a moment. So essentially, we need a mix of funding for buildings. Our natural resource asset preservation is needed to take care of our existing buildings, and then the betterment of buildings is needed for new construction or acquisitions. And so that's really when we're ready to replace, completely better that building. We use that fund when we're talking about rehabilitating existing buildings. That comes out of our natural resource asset preservation. I think it's important to note that both of these programs come out of statute, and the statutory sites are there on this slide as well. If you take both of these, well, what I will say is that betterment of buildings category is really our second priority, because it is equally important in ensuring that we have that building infrastructure to serve the state of Minnesota. Moving on then to public safety, because we have several requests that support public safety, including $9.5 million for wildfire aviation infrastructure, $20 million for dam safety, and $20 million for flood hazard mitigation grants. I probably don't need to dwell too much with all of you on how important that flood hazard mitigation grant program is going to be this year. With all of the snow, all of the precipitation having come into the winter with fall soils already being saturated, we are already preparing for spring floods. So that program is going to be extremely important. But interestingly enough, even though it's difficult to imagine right now in the snow, our folks are preparing for wildfire season. We know that dry period will come. It's a very important activity. I was actually in Brainerd yesterday, and our folks are starting to schedule out the wildfire staffing and planning. But we have a serious deficiency, particularly at the Hibbing air space for our fire infrastructure. The ramp at that airport has been deficient for quite some time, and it is now actually limiting the weight capacity that we can use at that ramp, which limits the ability we have to respond to wildfire needs. So that really is a critical need. We also have wildfire aviation needs at Grand Rapids and Brainerd as well, but Hibbing is incredibly critical. It is really in an emergency situation at this point. So we are asking for that. And then with the dam safety, the $20 million program there, this program is really critical to maintaining the structural integrity of the dams that we manage and maintain across the state, to prevent public safety hazards resulting from those dams and maintaining water levels on our rivers and lakes where we do that. The top priority in this request is the Lake Bronson State Park Dam. The current cost estimates are $17 to $22 million, so it really could encompass and would encompass that entire $20 million. But Lake Bronson is a high hazard dam, meaning that it has the potential for loss of life or serious economic loss if a failure was to occur, and so that also is in a very critical state to repair. I'm going to move on to the quality of life category, and in our public lands, we have $30 million for the acquisition and betterment of public lands. This again is another programmatic request. Within that, we are looking at $17 million for the acquisition of strategic inholdings and parcels, and $13 million for the betterment of land. And then also included in this category is $2 million for community tree planting grants. So those are dollars that would go to local communities for tree planting and improvements in those local places. Really, the key message here is that in order to continue to improve and conserve Minnesota's natural heritage and enrich the public outdoor recreation and enjoyment opportunities, we need to focus on those public lands. As I said, we manage 5.6 million acres of public lands. And we have opportunities sometimes, like this example on the screen, to acquire strategic inholdings. So in this particular example, this would be a forestry acquisition, the red being the proposed acquisition, the dark green color being DNR forestry land, the light green color being U.S. forest land, and the yellow being county ownership. This is a place where that red parcel currently is privately owned. You can see it is completely surrounded by DNR forestry land. There's a lot of federal forestry land. It is more efficient to manage the forest as a whole if we're able to acquire that from a willing landowner. So those are the types of strategic acquisitions that would be included in this proposal. And then the betterment piece includes reforestation of our lands. It includes the development of parking areas at our scientific and natural areas. It includes public water accesses, groundwater observation wells, and improvements in our hatcheries, specifically the hatchery ponds. So that, again, it's a programmatic request with a number of things in here, but all ensuring that we can manage our lands in a strategic and appropriate way to continue those public values. I'm going to shift gears entirely from the programmatic approach for a minute, and I'm going to talk briefly about one of the projects that we think is really essential to better serving Minnesotans, particularly in our state parks. So one of the projects that is included in the governor's recommendation is a $10 million project to improve accessibility at state parks, and specifically at William O'Brien and Fort Snelling state parks. And part of the goal here is our state parks are really not fully accessible to people with disabilities. We have components of the park that are accessible. And so obviously, you know, as we work on our buildings, they meet the requirements of the Americans with Disability Act. So those folks can access the parking lots. They can access the bathrooms, or at least most of them. Access the visitor center, perhaps, but you don't really get the full park experience if all you can see are the parking lots and the bathrooms and perhaps the visitor center. And so really what we want to do is make that whole park experience accessible to people with disabilities so that you can experience a trail, you can get to the picnic shelter and enjoy lunch with your family there. And so that's what this project and that's what this bonding request is about taking a park or two and really looking, working in partnership with the Council on Disabilities to make the full park experience accessible. And so I'm actually really personally excited about this project because I think it can serve as a great model for how we look at other spaces across our system. And then last but not least among our quality of life proposal is a focus on outdoor recreation. And so included in this is $5.8 million to provide a new campground and related amenities at Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park. And hopefully you're all aware that we have made significant investments in Minnesota's newest park, but obviously as our newest park, there's still much to do to fully develop that park into the 21st century park that we want it to be. And so the map on your slide just shows the completed projects in green, projects under construction are in the pink, projects in design and still unfunded are in blue, and then proposed projects that are a little bit further out are in yellow. And so this request would specifically help fund a campground in that park. And then the other piece of this request is $4 million for parks and trails, local and regional grant programs. And this is really important too for local communities who have park and trail needs. That's often where the public first gets introduced to the outdoors or their local parks and trails. And so it's a way that we can help support those local connections to the state amenities that we provide. And I think with that overview of our programs and projects, I will stop there, and Assistant Commissioner Lotthammer and I will be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, and thanks for speeding it up a little bit. Representative Ponstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really pleased to hear about the accessibility part. I sat at the One Minnesota conference yesterday with Representative Dan Fabian, and I can tell you that he was extremely angry that his brother, who has one leg, is denied access to some of the areas. And it was a conversation we had around the table about making things more accessible to our disability community. He wanted to take his brother into a park and was denied. So this is very timely, and thank you for your work on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. The report just given us, a similar one was given last year. Are there any significant additions or subtractions from what you presented last year?
Thank you. Chair and Representative, I'm assuming you're talking about this report, right, which is a January 2019 report. So the report itself is the same. We will be updating it December of this year, so it'll be new. We update it every 2 years. I don't know if there's any other updates, just not to the report, but otherwise.
Commissioner Lockhart.
Chair and Representative Erdahl, we do get updated information from the Department of Administration on the condition of buildings. We're actually in the process of getting that information and compiling it and developing just like a one-page insert that we'll be putting into this with that, because that information is provided annually, but the whole report is updated every 2 years.
Every 2 years?
Every 2 years, yes.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
That's a good question.
Thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're pressed for time here, but
and maybe this isn't the appropriate place and we can talk offline, but I just have to ask because you put Itasca County up there, and I was looking up the land acquisition that you're doing in Itasca County. That's U.S. Forest Service land that you're acquiring from the Forest Service. Is that right? Or my concern is there any private land ownership that's changing hands, and if so, are there any tax consequences for that?
Commissioner Stroman.
Chair Murphy and Representative Lehman, in that particular example, that was a private parcel that would come into public ownership. What I would tell you is we go through the whole strategic land asset management program, which includes reaching out to counties, getting that conversation and approval from the counties, and fully disclosing what any tax implications would be for a specific parcel. And if you would be interested in the specifics of that acquisition, we can get that to you offline.
Okay, great. And I can check with my county as well. So thank you for
Perfect.
That. And one other question, if I could, Madam Chair. Commissioner, we all, when we went on our tour for the capital investment projects, we saw a lot of your buildings and got a real firsthand appreciation for the condition and the concern, and we need to keep those up. You know, our parks are the pride and joy of the state. But we also stopped at the Can of Steel Pit. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we've talked about the Can of Steel Pit forever, and we thought we had a solution because a private company, Magnetation, was there, and they were pumping water out, and then they went out of business, and now we've got another, you know, public asset there that has a potential, I am told, by a person from the DNR, that it could actually start flooding over the banks in 2 years. So that's kind of a crisis that I think we need to address in this bonding cycle, and I'm just wondering, is that a bonding project? Is that a flood mitigation project? Is that a water infrastructure project? Or where would that fall in your plan?
Chair Stroman.
Chair Murphy and Representative Lehman, that is a great question. And we probably do not have time to give you the full answer here today. What I can say briefly is we are watching very closely that Can of Steel Pit project, as well as the St. James and Hill Annex pits as well. Parts of those projects are bondable, parts of them are not. And so we can get you the specifics on that. There are also some complexities of the ownership. These are all legacy mine pits that were in place before the modern mine reclamation. And so the responsibility for these pits has been in question. We have been working on monitoring those levels, and we can provide you more information on which costs are bondable, which are not, and talk more about some of the ownership complexities there.
And I'm sure we will.
And I know Representative Sandstein is interested in that.
Okay,
as well.
I would appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Today's the overview.
Yes.
Think the big picture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Mr. Harrington.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We took 5 minutes off for sure, off of your amount of time we told you you had. So I apologize for that, but hope that you can.
Chair Murphy, members of the committee, we will talk fast and I hopefully be informative as we move this along. So, my name is John Harrington. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And our mission is to serve all communities to build a safer Minnesota. The proposal you have in front of you has four projects. Each of them, I really do believe, speaks to that mission of serving all Minnesota. Our number one project is a new state emergency operations center. It is an all-hazards response center, and it quite literally touches every county and every municipality and every local government in the state of Minnesota. 87 counties have had emergency declarations, 11 tribal nations. And we need a facility that can handle both a response, a prevention, and a recovery from the worst day Minnesotans might have. We also need to build a facility that can handle the record amounts of drugs and other criminal information that's coming in to the state. I remember when I came on as a young cop, if we talked about heroin, we talked about it in bindles, little corners of a baggie that would be in heroin. Now I used to, when I was a St. Paul cop, I might talk about it in pounds occasionally, mostly in meth. And now I talk to my friends in Rochester, when I talk to my friends up in Bemidji, I'm talking 50 pounds, 100 pounds of meth. I'm talking about multiple pounds of heroin. I'm talking about massive amounts of fentanyl coming in, and we need to be able to facilitate the testing of those products so that we can, in fact, hold people accountable. We also, with while I don't think violent crime has necessarily gone up dramatically, the amount of physical evidence necessary to prosecute somebody for a violent crime has gone up, and we need space for DNA, and we also need space for people that can help us understand crime trends. I spend my nights worried about the next school shooting. I spend my nights worried about the next time a synagogue or a mosque or a church is attacked and someone is shot and killed in there. And we need to have the facilities so that when we have these kind of tips, we can share that information with the locals. We can make sure that we're out in front of this and not playing catch up, because playing catch up in this world means that somebody may die. That someone may be injured, and that's not an acceptable loss under any circumstances to me. Finally, we need a place to help train our first responders, and there's been a conversation about how many of those spaces we should have and how should we manage them and what kind of spaces we should have there. As I said, we have four projects. State Emergency Operations Center at $29.5 million, a Southern Minnesota BCA Regional Laboratory at Study Part at $125K, a improvement to the BCA's building at $3.6 million, and a regional training facility study that's at $500,000. Last year at this time, when I was the new commissioner, I was dealing with blizzards. But yesterday seemed like we were going to go right back into that whole piece again with shutting down highways and having to go out and send the National Guard out to help rescue literally hundreds and hundreds of Minnesotans stuck on our freeways. Shortly after that, I was down in Albert Lea with straight line winds that took out literally thousands of power poles and blacked out the neighborhoods down there. We had floods after that. Recently, I was meeting with my colleagues, the Homeland Security advisors from the other 50 states, and we had a conversation about what keeps us up at night as a collective. Targeted violence is definitely on the rise. It's something we're seeing more and more of, and we know that we're seeing the threats, and some of those threats come right back here to Minnesota. We're seeing cyber attacks that are literally crippling state agencies across the country. I sat with my colleague from Louisiana, who had a ransomware that basically took out their entire Department of Vehicle Services, because their DVS is connected to their revenue department, it shut them down for not just a day, it shut them down for almost a month. And we need to be able to respond to those. And then the coronavirus and health threats are also on the rise and things that we need to be able to respond to. The State Emergency Operations Center needs to be a no-fail facility. Our current facility is inadequate. I said yesterday I was meeting with our regional rep from FEMA. I remember walking in there with General Kelly and thinking to myself, well, where's the space for everybody to meet? Because the room is literally so small that there is no way possible to get all of the state, federal, and local reps in that you would need if you had a statewide emergency.
River Place.
Yes. It's currently located in leased space in the Town Square complex. We're paying $500,000 a year for a facility that's not adequate. It's mixed use. It's in a densely developed downtown area, almost immediately adjacent to the Capitol, which means that anything that would happen at the Capitol complex would likely take out the Emergency Operations Center, which means that you would have no backup place for the continuity of government. The SEOC, among other things, is the place that if something awful happened here, we would relocate you, the state government leadership, to, so that we could reestablish state order. And if we're that close to ground zero, that's just simply not going to happen. It doesn't have backup power, it doesn't have enough room, and it doesn't have any way for us to get the technology in that we need in order for us to do a really good job there. What we're proposing is a $29.5 million property purchase, development, and construction. When we talk to our folks from FEMA and DHS, they give us some criteria as to what we should be looking for. They suggest 10 to 15 miles from your state capitol complex is ideal. And so we drew the big circle and figured out where that would be. It needs to have access control so that you can be able to control who gets in and who gets out, but it has to have good enough transportation networks so that if we're trying to move a couple hundred people into the building to manage the state, we can still do that. So it can't be someplace where it's completely remote, but it has to be far enough off of the beaten path that it's not going to get overrun. And we need to be located away from known risk and hazard areas. As we work with the Department of Administration's real estate, we've been able to find a location in the Blaine area that we believe meets all of these criteria. And so we believe, and having worked with the city, that we have located the right spot. And now it's a matter of figuring out where the right building is and moving forward with that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Lee has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, real quickly, can you tell me how is this different from, don't we have an emergency training center in Camp Ripley or no?
We do, sir. Representative Lee, we do have a training facility at Camp Ripley, but that is viewed as being too distant for us to relocate the continuity of government. And it would still cost a significant amount of money to be able to build up the SEOC at that area.
Thank you.
I'm not going to go through the details of the request. You have those in front of you. But it does involve purchase of a commercial lot. It does involve design, site preparation, and all of the factors that would go into building a facility that way. It does meet, this proposal does meet our strategic priorities of improving our ability to provide a range of DPS programs, including training, including meetings. A lot of what Homeland Security Emergency Management does is they do preparation. They do prevention work. They are training. Yesterday I was up at the Earl Brown Center. We met with literally 400 emergency managers from all over across the state who are preparing for the worst day ever, trying to figure out what the next hazard's going to be and trying to figure out how can they get in front of this so they can pre-position the assets and pre-train their first responders so that when it does happen, we are ready and able to respond immediately. It will fill a critical need for a modern and reliable state emergency operations center, and it will provide that continuity of governance facility that we need to have. At this time, I'm going to turn this over to...
Before you turn it over, do the locals know that you might be coming?
Madam Chair, we have talked to the city officials in Blaine. We have talked to the local police department, and they are aware that we may be coming.
But what about the people that live around there and the people that never thought they'd see so many people coming at one time to talk about danger?
Madam Chair, I don't believe we've had that conversation in a broad sense. We have identified the location. We have talk to the city officials, and I think once we actually figure out the actual physical spot where this would be located, then it would be appropriate at that time to try and do a public information campaign.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This morning I wasn't expecting that we'd be talking about building the undisclosed location that we would go to if there was a problem here, but with that, if that's what we're building, if we're building something that is in response or a safe place, essentially. I want to ask about energy use. So if you're connected to the grid, I would think there would be some potential for risk. And I'm wondering with the buildings under your purview, if there should be a resiliency of having independent energy sources on those, for example, solar on the rooftops or the distributed energy so that you can produce your own energy in case there was a meltdown, whether it's physical or whether it's in terms of chaos. So that's my question is, do you have plans in these buildings for independent energy production?
Madam Chair, sure, Representative, we have discussed making sure that that we do have a resilient redundancy factor in terms of how we would power the site, and as we would build this out, I think it does make sense. The last few buildings that I've been involved with constructing have in fact had solar to be there as a supplement to the power grid, but in this case what we're really looking for is we're going to look for backup generators, because if we had a true emergency, we cannot wait for things to be able to cut over, and that's the situation we are in currently. Is if the power went out in Town Square and we had an emergency here, We would not be able to operate because the power generation system there is not adequate to run even the small SEOC we do have.
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I am going to talk about a couple of projects that the commissioner already noted. As the commissioner noted in his opening comments, we've experienced significant increases in the amount of testing we've been doing in our laboratories. The number of drug cases, just as an example, have gone from 5,000 cases just 5 years ago to well over 11,000 last year in through our laboratory systems. Same thing when it goes to DNA. DNA has become critical to our criminal investigations across Minnesota. We've seen a significant increase in the number of sexual assault examination kits. And this project that the governor recommends is designed to meet the increasing needs into the future of Minnesota so that we're prepared to meet the community needs across Minnesota. 120% increase in DNA, as was noted before. Digital multimedia evidence is another area that we continue to see increases. And part of the design for this project is that we are simply out of space at our headquarters location that I'll talk about in a little bit. And this will meet the increasing demands that we see into the future for Minnesota. Go ahead, madam.
You're out of space at the headquarters. That's the one over in St. Paul?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, we are. In fact,
what's
I'll talk.
That's the Randy Kelly building?
That is, ma'am. So I will talk about that in a little bit, but just the examples we use there in that particular location. In the last year, we went to 6x6 cubicles in our Mingus area to meet those increasing needs. And one of the other projects is to build out the remaining space within that building. This location would also be located in southern Minnesota to be in close proximity to all of our partners across the southern part of the state. We receive a lot of evidence through the mail. That concerns me from a standpoint as it would be better to have people dropping that evidence off directly to us to maintain the chain of custody so there's no disruption in the flow of that evidence that would eliminate the need to provide those transfers. The governor and his bonding recommendations recommends $125,000 for pre-design location. I will show you a picture of our Bemidji Regional Office located in northern Minnesota. It'd be modeled after that location. It would house both our laboratory and investigative functions in that location, which is what we do in our Bemidji Regional Office. We'd be approximately a 40,000 square foot building, and it would plan for both our current and future needs to meet those increasing demands for service that we're seeing all across Minnesota. As we noted at our headquarters location, we have maximized all the space in that location in our laboratory space. It's a wonderful laboratory. It's a beautiful building, but we're out of space, especially in our DNA laboratory and our drug laboratory, which is where we see the most pressure on those services. Some of the services, just to give you an idea, that we offer in those locations is evidence intake and processing. So we take in the evidence at that location, DNA, drug chemistry, latent prints, firearms and tool marks, which are critical to investigations as well. We'd be looking at a crime scene response. The commissioner has asked me on a couple of different locations this year. We were out on three different crime scenes at the same time. We have two crime scene vehicles, one in St. Paul and Bemidji. And how do we balance those? Having a third option for us to respond to communities across Minnesota means they will not be waiting hours or we're scrambling to put together ad hoc teams to respond to those crime scenes across Minnesota. Digital multimedia evidence, and then our investigative services really is the full suite of what we provide assistance to local law enforcement. Homicide, violent crimes, missing persons, predatory crimes, internet crimes against children, online exploitation of children, financial crimes, narcotics trafficking, crime scene again, and multimedia, which is what we do together. This just offers you as an example. The building, if you've seen it, we'd welcome all of you to visit our Maryland facility if you ever wish to visit there, is in Bemidji. It looks like a miniature version of that and is really a truly a regional office. Our headquarters location that you noted, and I think I saw the surprise on your face, Madam Chair, it's a very big building and it met our needs very well. We quickly filled that space as we've met the ongoing needs of Minnesota. It's a 225,000 square foot building, and safety and security are really paramount to our operations. The BCA processes approximately 65,000 pieces of evidence a year in the most high profile complex cases, from homicide investigations to attacks on mosques, synagogues, churches, as the commissioner noted, and it's really important that we provide security for that location to ensure that if there was a disruption to operations, it would be very challenging to relocate all of our operations to Bemidji facility, and so having additional redundancy even for the southern office would help us with that, but we want to secure this facility as best we can. We were looking at ways to improve the security in this location, which we've done. We've installed blast film on our windows across this facility to thwart any potential attacks that may come. One of the things that was recommended to us by the Department of Homeland Security is to provide better fencing security. Right now, we're on Maryland Avenue on the east side of St. Paul. If somebody were to drive a large truck right off of the street into our building, it would have the potential to significantly disrupt our operations. So one of the requests is to build a fence on three sides of the building. The picture you see is a rendition that would provide that from here, and then we have no additional space at that facility. That perimeter security would also provide security to our employees at that location. We recently did a statewide survey on the safety of our employees, among a number of different things. Employees did note their safety is concerns that they have at that facility at different times, and so this would provide some of that enhanced security from there. Part of the reason this fence is a little more than one might think it would cost is this fence would be a catch fence. It would stop vehicles from going through the fence and being able to impact the facility. It would also provide proper standoff distances if anybody were to, or I shouldn't say proper, better standoff distances if anybody were to put a bomb, for example, on the road. It would protect the building better in that location. The other part would be to finish the remaining 7,600 square feet. When this building was originally built, one portion that was not built was intended to be a gun range. We do not have a need for a gun range at the BCA. We have many other partners. Some of the other regional facilities that you've provided bonding money for, we can access and utilize those locations. And so we would build out the remaining 7,600 square feet for the additional space that we need. One of the areas that we're very cramped right now, the commissioner noted, is in our criminal information and operations. This houses all of our information services that we take in suspicious activity reporting, reporting on school threats, reporting on threats to our faith institutions across Minnesota, and this would better position us to create partnerships that we existing have but don't have space to house them to come into this location as well, so we could operate jointly to protect Minnesota from those threats as they're ongoing. We have no additional investigative space. As we've noted, this is two parts, but part of what we're looking for down in southern Minnesota is as a request to add agents to our operations. We really need that space ongoing. We don't have it in our investigative space right now. This would add an additional 44 workstations and utilize our existing space. Maintains collaborative access to our partners that can easily access the space. It's right in through our front doors, so they'd be able to access it easily. And this would also put us in a good position to be able to meet those needs kind of into the future that we have at our space. For example, we have the Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force. It's a statewide task force. We've kind of ad hoc pushed them into one space. Same thing with our Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. We'd like additional partners to co-locate with them, but we simply do not have the space at the building to do that right now. So this space will be done. HVAC is already plumbed into this location. It's heated. The wiring is there, but the money would build out the space in there to utilize ongoing. And then this is just an example of what that fence in the red would be right now. There really is a very low fence that provides no security on. As you look at the right and bottom side of your screen, this will provide a more secure fence around the remaining portion of that. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it back over to the commissioner unless there's questions.
Superintendent, we don't have time to talk about fences today, but I invite you to have a meeting with Representative Lee and I about the fence. Former correctional person. I kind of have feelings about fences. How many trucks have driven off?
We have not
way into your buildings in the past.
We have not had a fence drive into our building, Madam Chair. I will tell you that we have had a significant problem with people breaking out our windows, being so located so closely to that location. That's $5,000 every time a window is broken. We had a murder occur in front of the building 2 years ago in the middle of the afternoon. The building is shot on a fairly regular basis, and that's just part of being in an urban core area. But it's incumbent upon ourselves to make sure that we're providing the security, you know, to that facility going on forward.
We'll consider fences later. Yeah, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the commissioner. Welcome, Commissioner. Back to the, you mentioned Homeland Security when you were talking about the new center. Do they have requirements as to how this is built, and is there any potential resources available from the federal government?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, FEMA and Department of Homeland Security have recommendations. I have not seen any dollars that would be capital dollars. They have dollars that we typically can access for information services and for consultation, but I have not seen any federal dollars that would allow us to build. I believe that is currently the case, but I'm happy to continue that conversation with our partners at federal DHS.
Thank you.
We invite them to contribute money.
I'm happy to go begging there, too. No problem whatsoever on that.
Good for you.
So, the last item we have, and which is very, very brief, is a conversation I've had across the state of Minnesota. There are hundreds of police departments and literally hundreds of fire departments, and first responders are required by state law to receive training. And so the question is, where should those trainings occur, and are there more efficient ways of delivering those trainings so that police officers, firefighters, emergency EMTs can all be trained on a regular basis without having them to drive to the cities from greater Minnesota, and so that we can make sure that they are trained regularly and trained adequately. In order to do that, we've looked at a regional model of establishing regional training facilities. At one point, I must have had a dozen different requests for training facilities that kept popping up. It seemed like every municipality was asking for their own training facility, and it makes more sense, we believe, to look at a regional response to that. In order to do that, we have worked with MMB, MAD in particular, to begin work on following up on a study that they did. And so what we're looking for is $500,000 of general fund money to do this needs assessment and to work out what would be a plan for developing regional police fire training facilities.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I've been on this committee my whole time here, and it seems that every year, every biennium, we get a request for a regional training facility somewhere in the state of Minnesota. I'm curious if, you know, and sometimes they're not brought by public safety. They're brought by, you know, agencies in other parts of the state. And I'm curious, at some point, are we going to develop a master, or is that what this is for, a master plan to say, you know, do we have officers traveling 200 miles, or is the average, you know, distance an officer would travel might be, you know, 100 miles or less? I mean, I think that's what the study's intended to do, but I really want to hear it that, yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to use the state payers' money smartly, and we're going to have a coordinated effort on our regional training centers throughout the state.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, you are exactly on top, on point. Okay. That is exactly what this study is designed to do, is to make a best case for what do we need, where do we need it, and how is the best model for providing the training so that we can stop having the annual conversation about I need one this much closer. Because there are issues. I talked to the smaller departments who say traveling even 100 miles for them to go to a training becomes onerous if they have to pay per diem, they have to pay hotel costs. So having a regional facility that's located in the right spots, that provides the right training that and is designed to provide that wide suite of training that cops and firefighters need really does make, I think, the most sense for using the taxpayers' dollars.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank
and
you, Commissioner.
Representative Dean, we did have a plan for regional centers in the 90s. And
okay.
I'm sure that could be dug out and used as a what happened now, what happened so that it's not working now. But we'll seriously consider this and then go into all those details about it. And I really think that it has become time. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Appreciate.
Madam Chair, in the essence of time, I won't ask a question, but I would be No, that's fine. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Hero Center in Cottage Grove that just opened with a significant investment from the Capital Investment Committee in the state of Minnesota that is a model for first responder training centers.
And you are inviting us.
I have, and we'll have that discussion, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yep. I knew that. But you're right. And we did have a training center for both fire and police. I thought it was established back then. And then somebody else wanted it closer, or somebody didn't want it this or that. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
And we took 7 minutes off your time, so you're really going to have to talk fast.
That's okay.
But we have to listen carefully. And there will be more opportunities because the statistics are astonishing.
Yeah.
Or were to me when I heard them.
Right. Hello. Welcome. Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Laura Bishop. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. 1 year into the job, and certainly
me too.
Yeah, sure. No lack of work at the MPCA right now. We've got a lot on our plate, and certainly am excited to represent the agency today. So with our bonding proposals, really we're looking at all of these that pertain to our core mission of protecting and protecting and improving the environment and human health. And I think we're just getting our slideshow up, but certainly really we look at the agency, we break things up into three core areas of our regulatory work on land, air, and water. And our core products and services are monitoring air, land, and water for contaminants, issuing permits and enforcing regulations, educating to prevent pollution, which is always the easiest way if we can prevent it, finding and cleaning up contamination, responding to emergencies and spills, and then setting environmental rules and policies. Our first bonding proposal that I'll talk about is really for electric vehicle infrastructure. So as we see the expansion of EVs in our states, in our state as a priority, mainly for cleaning up our air, as well as we know that passenger vehicles are the largest source of greenhouse gases and air pollution here in Minnesota. So we're building off of the study that we saw from MnDOT, which we participated in, which looked at pathways to decarbonization in the transportation sector, which really looked at options to put forward for expanding our EV infrastructure and availability of EVs. So this would look at ways that we can put in additional charging stations. The $12 million in grants for EV charging stations in greater Minnesota largely focused so that we can expand on that network. What we have seen and with the VW settlement is, only we're precluded from spending more than 15% of that settlement money on charging infrastructure. So we're looking to ensure that we have enough charging infrastructure here in the state. The priority has always been given to fast chargers on high use corridors. So we have a map as well that we can walk through, but that should be in on the bonding proposal packets. But what we've seen when we put out our grants for charging infrastructure that in even that 15% of the VW settlement is there is a high interest and high demand. We had like 120%, I think our stat was, over
the amount that we could allow under the grant or under the VW settlement. So this governor's recommendation includes an additional $2 million for the Department of Administration's request for EV charging stations to help with state vehicles as well. We also have a proposal for $15 million that's for sustainable communities and climate resilience. So climate resilience really looks at the ability of our systems to anticipate, absorb, accommodate, and recover from the effects of weather events and intensified by climate change. We've seen a 20% increase in total precipitation just in the Twin Cities, but we know when we look at southern Minnesota, we look all over, this is a real problem for cities and with the amount of precipitation. So what we're looking at this is a grant that would, I'll pass through this, we've talked about the intensity of rainfalls and intensity of precipitation, and I talked with Representative Torkelson just now about an event in his district as well, but this would establish a pilot program with a $15 million bonding appropriation. The grants would go to Minnesota communities, and our first focus really would be on stormwater. Stormwater doesn't get all the attention that I think it could, but we know with these rainfalls that are getting larger and larger in precipitation that we need bigger pipes and we need to be planning out for this. So this would help to mitigate that. It could fund 5 to 10 pilot projects. We know there's a lot more out there that would want funding for this, and we'd expect to have a local match to go along with this. Then we have cleanup for 4 Superfund sites, and I do have our Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka here that could talk through these specific ones, but that I can turn over to Kirk if that's okay.
Assistant Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka, and I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As the Commissioner mentioned, we have 4 Superfund sites that we would like to move forward with bonding projects. These sites are the responsibility of the state. There are not viable responsible parties to do the work, so it falls upon the state to be able to do it. Direct risk and pathways have been addressed, such as wells that may need treatment or that. However, the long-term source of the pollution is still in the ground, and we need to move forward to be able to stop the spread from continuing and start the groundwater to start repairing the groundwater. We have a very limited budget right now from the remediation fund, and that is really targeted to emergencies, addressing health impacts, and the operation and maintenance of systems already in place. So these projects do not move forward. The 4 sites here are just real quickly on each of them. The ESCO groundwater contamination site is a former dry cleaner, engine repair shop, and creamery, and we're dealing with volatile organic compounds, VOCs. We've addressed the drinking water issues at the post office and neighboring private wells, and however, the Midway River is still half a mile away. Our goal here is to excavate the contaminants and also apply a biological treatment to aid in the removal of the source material, which is contributing to the groundwater contamination. The second site is the Duluth dump, number 1. This is a site that has accepted municipal solid waste and construction and demolition waste. We have had some consolidation of waste here, but in many spots there's thin cover or waste is actually exposed to the public. Here we have concerns about volatile organic compounds again, but also PAHs, PCBs, and methane being produced from the landfill. Our goal here is to consolidate the waste under a proper cover and also remove some materials to protect the surrounding area. The next is the Perm Arsenic Superfund site. This was a site that was used for disposal of unused arsenic grasshopper bait back in the 30s and 40s. It is buried on a part of the fairgrounds in Otter Tail County. And arsenic is the concern here, where we had contamination of drinking water wells previously that have been addressed. However, we still have arsenic in the ground, and our goal here would be to demo buildings that have been built on top of it, remove that soil and excavate it and put it in a proper area. The last one is precision plating in Minneapolis. The concern here is an old plating company that operated from 1961 to 2003, and our concerns again are VOCs, volatile organic compounds. Not only what is impacting the groundwater, but concerns with potential soil vapor intrusion and Bassett Creek being just a tenth of a mile from the location. Here too, we would demo the actual building, work on excavation, and actually do also a chemical injection into the soil to get to the chemicals at hard to reach places to help remove the contaminants that's feeding into the plume. In all these cases, the best solution for long-term repair of these areas is for us to go in, remove the source that does not keep leaching into the surrounding area and potentially posing risk to human health and the environment.
Commissioner, question, Representative Lee.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, can you talk about how you went with prioritizing these four different sites, and what about Pig's Eye? I remember sitting in the Environment Finance Committee, and you said that it will take around over $700 million. And so I was just wondering, why did that not make the list, or what are your criteria in figuring this out?
Chair and committee members, Pig's Eye is a landfill in St. Paul here. The $700 million is the high end of the expense for that landfill. Right now we're using what is called the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust, MLCAT. We just recently submitted a report to the legislature that outlines our plans to use that fund. It has an eligible funding source. The report does outline, though, the funds in the MLCAT are insufficient to do the work, but it will allow for us to start various parts of the cleanup at Pig's Eye. We'd be more than happy to talk to you in more detail at a later time if you'd like to go into more details of each of those specifics, but we do have a funding source to start that work, and that these four sites do not have that funding source. So we've prioritized those where we see there's the need to move forward on our Superfund side that don't have that source of funding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. So I am concerned that they're not listed here. You know, being on the east side of St. Paul, where we have communities of color, low wealth communities, and having the Mississippi River as a drinking water source, and when I'm not seeing us prioritize that with the huge amount of costs, I really am concerned with some of the investment that we are making. And so I will, you know, like for us to have further conversation on what can we do to address that situation and these different situations that we are having here in your request.
Representative Jergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Kadalka, I'd like to go back to the electric vehicle stations. I just have some questions on that, please. First of all, there's a partnership here, it appears, or is there a partnership with public and private? Who would maintain these charging stations? Would they generate revenue? You know, do you have to pay to charge your vehicle? And then there's looks like in the documentation, a 20% match for grantees. A lot of what we have for matches are 50-50. I'm just kind of curious about those things. If you could shed some more light on that, please.
Sure. So, Madam Chair, Representative Jergens. So, I have our experts on how the grants are dispersed, but my understanding on most of these is that, you know, we put these up for the cities and municipalities often to bid on these, and then it would fall into their hands to maintain. But I'll turn it over to you. I might be wrong, and if I am, my trusty staff can correct me.
Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Brian Timerson. I'm a supervisor with the Pollution Control Agency. And yeah, there's a 80-20% match. The municipality would spend 20%. These funds would provide 80%. They would receive funding from the charging, that the charger, whoever's using the charger, would pay for a portion of the charging, and it would be maintained by the municipality.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner and Deputy Commissioners. I mean, we're looking back at harms from 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. And these are really, you know, when Representative Lee talks about the cost of the Pig's Eye site, these are huge dollar amounts. Yes. And yet, and this is sort of a philosophical statement, We still permit pollution. I mean, that's what you guys do. Mm-hmm. And part of what you do is you permit pollution. So 40, 50 years from now, we're probably going to be seeing other impacts of what is being done today. And I'm curious if there's been any sort of backroom conversations that at some point we have to stop polluting.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's just, you know, we're kind of kicking the can down the road and trying to make repairs from the past history. So that's as much of a statement as a question. And are you all having those types of conversations as well?
To that point, I have an additional question to put into the mix. Do we have, you said that we were going to take the arsenic ground out and put it in a safer dump. Do we have that? Do we have a safer place?
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, I'll answer the first question. I'll let Assistant Commissioner Kadelka answer the second one. So, yes, we have those conversations. What I will say is, you know, we balance the responsibilities of protecting and improving the environment and human health and economic development here in the state to and economic viability. I will say that, yes, I have concerns about our state of pollution, our air quality, especially in many of the environmental justice areas that Representative Lee has noted. And what I will say is that we prioritize and we will be prioritizing always on through our permitting process as well as our cleanups based on the impact to those communities for environmental justice. We also need to be looking at on the cleanup the economic viability and future on that. But through our permitting, one of the lenses that we will look through and continue to look through is environmental justice, and the governor has challenged us, all agencies, when we look at our budgets, when we look at our bonding, when we look at our responsibilities, to be looking through the lens of equity, and that is something I take very seriously.
Mr. Assistant Commissioner.
Chair and committee members, regarding the sites for excavation, whether arsenic or the VOCs, we have modern facilities now that are designed for various types of contamination, whether it's solid waste or hazardous waste. And depending on the characterization of the waste we pull out, would have to go to a lined system that collects leachates and has proper venting for methane. That's what these sites don't have. There is no liner. There's complete access to the groundwater, access for rainwater to percolate through it and deliver it in other places. And so we would move it to a proper containment device facility, landfills in the state or out of the state if necessary.
Commissioner, could we complete the third part of your presentation in the next 8 minutes?
Great.
Could we? Yep. I mean, is that possible to complete that portion? Mm-hmm. So we would have the whole presentation today, mm-hmm. even though we may have questions later.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. So moving on to the last sections. We can go through these, I think, pretty quickly. This next one is $2 million for removing PAH contaminated stormwater pond sediment. This is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, often as a result of runoff from tar and sealants, and many of our municipal ponds are facing this issue with the PAH. So rough estimate, up to 30% of these stormwater municipal ponds, public ponds, are contaminated. So this would go toward alleviating some of that. And then the final one is our capital assistance program. And I've asked Kirk to, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka to stay up here, but really these are looking at how we can divert a lot of different items to our from our landfills and the organic and food waste being number one. We toured Washington Ramsey County's facility yesterday to look at their request and really to look at ways that these CAP grants will go to local governments for recycling infrastructure, composting infrastructure, and reuse programs. And this is the list that we have here, and we can walk through those in more detail if people are have questions on specific ones. We'd be happy to answer those as well. Okay, and then this one is for the closed area landfill, $1.33 million, and I'll let Assistant Commissioner talk about that.
Just real quickly, the Brookston area landfill is located within the Fond du Lac Reservation. This is a old landfill. As you know, we have the closed landfill program. I want to thank the committee for its previous work to help us with WDE and Andover and Anoka County. This is a similar situation where we have another landfill that needs proper closure. The concern here is elevated manganese because of an insufficient cap. Rainwater is allowed to go through, mix with the organic materials, create what's called a redox situation, which pulls natural occurring manganese from the soils and then makes a plume and moves off-site from the location. So our goal here is to consolidate the waste, put a proper cover on it, and methane venting system.
Mm-hmm. And that concludes our presentation. So questions, Madam
We're
Chair?
We're full of questions. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Bishop, thanks for the testimony this morning. Just a kind of a technical question, but well, not technical question, but a general question of why we're using appropriation bonding dollars instead of just using general fund dollars. In some ways, I recognize what Representative Dean is addressing in the fact that this is past pollution, and usually our bonding requests are for future benefits. And so I always feel okay with bonding for things that people today are going to use for the next 30 years.
Sure.
But this is an opportunity. This is maybe an opportunity, especially with the circumstance of our current surplus. Is this traveling as a separate general fund request as well?
Madam Chair,
sure.
Representative. So what I will say is, and I'll let Kirk talk to that specifically. But we have a lot of our budget is for those future projects. So the $49.2 million in the capital assistance programs is really to prevent and to build that infrastructure and put that in place. The cleanup projects, I'll let Assistant Commissioner Kudelka really talk through why we use bonding for those as well.
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair and committee members, it is true that the contamination occurred many times decades ago, but the benefits are for the long term and the future of the state. Mm-hmm. We are looking to improve one of our most important resources, our natural resources, and our groundwater. So what we're doing is the work we do today will pay dividends over the next several decades as we continue to clean up these locations. The use of the appropriation of bonds for these Superfund sites it allows for more flexibility. What our remediation program's goal is to do is to clean up sites and turn them back onto the tax rolls. Working with MMB, appropriation bonds will allow for us some more leeway and flexibility to achieve that mission, to clean up sites and put them back into reuse versus a general obligation bond that is non-taxable. We would have to have the state owning the property potentially for longer or other restrictions on it. So we're exploring the flexibility appropriation bonds would allow for us to have with MMB.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that explanation. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, wouldn't general fund dollars also give you that flexibility?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair and committee members, general fund dollars could be used, but these are projects that have a capital nature that have benefits over decades, much like all the other improvement projects that are done in bonding, so they fit well in that same category as the other bond projects.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just encourage that this at this time that these types of projects where it's a one-time type of spending event or occurrence is something that I would encourage that we consider having this travel as a separate issue. And I did want to address the point that, you know, the comment that was made about how you're permitting to pollute, and in many ways, I think there's three M's to that of managing, mitigating, and minimizing pollution, and I think that's the role and the job of what we're trying to do. And sometimes I hear these comments that are thrown out about the environmental justice and whatnot, and I just want to always remind people that if we're not, I mean, we are turning on light switches, using cell phones, driving cars, using metal, using all kinds of resources every day. And the state of Minnesota, I think, does that in one of the most responsible manners in the world. And anytime we start putting up these obstacles and making it impossible to have those, I guess you could call them commerce, you could call it pollution. Anytime that we don't allow that to happen in the state of Minnesota, chances are it will happen somewhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do kind of give a lot of lip service to this. And I know from personal experience of what those impacts are around the world. And I always encourage people to keep their eye on the entire stream of commerce and the impacts that we have when we start, you know, shutting things down and saying, well, we can't have any pollution occurring here. I think that that's just irresponsible, and it ultimately has a more negative impact on our planet. And I think our state does a great job. I think we've got folks in the Iron Range that have done very responsible things and managed and mitigated the best that they can. And for my part, even some of our what we currently think are the most environmentally friendly aspects of this, we're starting to learn that, hey, you know, some of these wind turbines, when they're decommissioned, they're going to take some dollars and some have an impact on our state and our planet as well. I think that even the decommissioning of solar panels, we've got to be planning for that. And I don't know the science and the math of all of those impacts at this point. I don't know that many of us do, and I think we just should all be a little more responsible and a little more careful with what we say and do in committee and recognize that all of these things have impacts. And so unless you want to shut off the lights and not have a cell phone and not drive a car, you know, we do need to figure out how to do this in a responsible manner. So thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to probably just lay out a few questions. You can choose which ones you want to even attempt to take on. One is
lay out the questions, and
I'll do them quickly.
We won't attempt to answer.
In fact, don't even try to answer any of these.
We'll write them all down.
Number one, there's a huge number of local water runoff ponds in a lot of cities and jurisdictions in the state. They are silent, small, abandoned pollution sites. That pond where everything ran off the street, ran off the yard, ran off the whatever, and got caught in that basin, and then ran to the bottom and sedimented and all that sort of thing, became a Superfund site for the future. Mm-hmm. They are all over our state right now, and most of them have no maintenance plan, no care plan, and are being ignored because they're deep in a bunch of cattails. So I would just like to lay that before you, that there is a new kind of hidden thing that could be out there. I think if nothing else, planning in that regard would help a lot. I have the same caution about EVs. We are running around trying to push money into promoting EVs and that sort of thing, and I would guess that trying to end life with an EV battery is no fun. It probably takes a huge mental capacity and a certain demand on engineering and resources to get those metals into an inert state that could at least be safely stored or returned out to the future.
I think that, that's probably one of the things that in pollution planning, one of the things we do is we forget to think with one brain. So in Olmsted County, we have burned everything, turned it into energy, plus we have then pollution. You can't avoid it. We're burning. It's carbon. But we have almost no public landfill left. The whole construction landfill that was owned by the city and the county is now recycled through the burner and is empty. There is no residual water contamination and all those things. That's gone in that facility. Then what I heard you say was, I heard you say in some ways, it's better for us to dig it up and to move it along. That's something I want to be careful that we make those generalized stations or statements, because then that gets turned into public policy. And we are now under a gun in Olmsted County for people that are saying, we want to shut down your county burner. Yeah. That's an interesting thing after we've spent several million dollars of public taxpayer money to quiet the risk of those pollutants and to try to turn them into a useful resource, and yet now we're going to be told that we shut it down, which means create a new place to manage your waste and create. So we need to think as if we at least are somewhat close to having one mind and one brain. And I know that those were from statements from different departments. So one is from the health department, one is from the environment department, and one is from the pollution control agency. We have three brains, three different messages to the public. So there we go. I'm done.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.